So all you art buffs out there, subscribe to 3CR.
Renegade economists saying, yeah.
Economics for activists. Economics is being made. Economics. These are the tools activists need. How can we calculate it? What motivates them? And why do people spend money? Understand the basics.
This week on The Renegades, we have Professor Steve Keen. Yes, Steve Keen, one of Australia's most controversial economists. In the middle of his big, big walk, he lost a bet with Macquarie Bank's Rory Robertson. He's walking from Canberra to Mount Kosciuszko to protest the price of Australian housing. You're with Carl Fitzgerald, Steve Keen, friend of ours who did a lot of behind-the-scenes work with the Michael Hudson tour. He's had a lot of publicity over this walk, and check out his website, keenwalk.com.au, to track his progress.
Very warm welcome back to our old friend Steve Keen. Haven't been on the show for a long time, but Steve, thank you for joining us during, you're probably at the three-quarter mark of your huge walk from Canberra to Mount Kosciuszko. How is it going out there on the road?
Oh, it's going wonderful. It's one of the best holidays I've had, mate. It's wonderful. We're having a great old time. The party of people who come along with me. Anybody who's going to take something on has to both be ethical on their attitudes to how society should function. So that's a major part of what I'm on about. And a bit of a maverick to even attempt something like this. So we're having a ball.
So people can follow this on your specially set up blog, keenwalk.com.au.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. I'm just putting a pretty brief daily update, because I must say at the end of each day I'm pretty buggered, because the average distance we're doing each day is a bit over 30 kilometres. So you get back after that, and when I'm running hard the first half and walking the second, it's a fair strain. So I put about 400 or 500 word posts, much shorter than the ones I'm famous for on debt deflation. Rob, I once saw somebody linked to my site as saying, the link said, world's longest blog post.
That's right. Well, your Debt Watch reports certainly are very well respected, and it seems like they're winding up. You're not going to be doing them for much longer because you're headstrong into a book.
Yeah, I've realised, actually, when I was on holidays in Hawaii with my girlfriend's birthday, I was there, I was tapping the Debt Watch out because it was due, because we were falling over the first Tuesday in April. And I thought, this is crazy, because I spent, three or four days on a holiday typing out a report. And I realized that really the reason I started the report was to raise the alarm about the global financial crisis, which I saw coming, and so did Michael Hudson and a handful of other non-orthodox economists. And I knew that if I didn't raise the alarm beforehand, I wouldn't be taken seriously later, saying, I could have predicted that. So the Debt Watch report made the prominence and got the arguments out before it happened. But now what I want to do is the deep analysis, which, of course, I've been committed to write for about the last 10 years. Debunking economics got in the way of the book in the first instance. And I now know that I've just got to say, done the Debt Watch, now I'm going to work on the book.
I bet you nearly fell over yourself when you saw the recent debt saturation chart discussing the diminishing marginal productivity of debt. It was showing in 2009 how each dollar of debt added negative 15 cents to productivity at the end of 2009. And it seems like that's just going to continue with US policies.
Well, it's a reasonable look at it. I mean, I combine change in debt to income, because they're both dimensioned the same way. So debt to GDP is income per year, and change in debt is a change in indebtedness on an annual basis as well. So those two things are more coherent. But that marginal productivity one is a reasonable way of putting the same argument, that for a long time debt added to GDP, and now, of course, there's a negative feedback because debt has become so great that you're actually becoming more of a Ponzi economy with less productivity, courtesy of the level of debt we've got into.
One of your DebtWatch Post discussed how debt's been growing faster than GDP at 4.2% faster in Australia's case for over 40 years. In America, there's been at 2.7% faster. A lot of people think that Australia, that America is the debt kings, but really Australians are doing a fair job at it themselves.
Yeah, America's debt ratio began to rise right at the end of 1945. You had debt was paid down radically from the peak it reached back in the Great Depression, from about 215% of peak debt, or 235, I've got my figures in front of me right now, percent of GDP in 1932, and it plunged down to about 45-50%. Right from that point, America's debt ratio, private debt ratio, was rising. Public debt fell over the whole period, so it looked, if you look at the aggregate level, you didn't see anything going wrong. But I've always said it's more important to focus upon private debt than government debt. And when you look at the private debt, it began to rise from about 45% of GDP, grew at about 2.8% per annum, and it's now hit, over that period of, you know, 60, going on 70 years, it's hit 300% of GDP. We, on the other hand, had very stable debt from 1945 to 1965. Our debt ratio was 25%, tiny fluctuations around that level, rising and falling, and at that level, the change in debt was trivial as a contributor to demand in the economy. Then in mid-1964, it all started to change, and from that point on, debt began to grow at 4.2% per annum. So having started with half the debt level the Americans had 20 years earlier, growing at 4.2%, of course, we rapidly got to the stage where we reached 165% of debt, debt-to-GDP ratio in 2008. Then we started to fall, but the real danger of our situation is that governments these days have realised that one of the easiest ways to get an artificial but effective boost to the economy is to stimulate the private debt bubble again. They don't actually consciously know that, I think, but that's what their policies do. And that's what got us out of the 73 slump. It got us out of the 90 recession we had to have. And really what's happened with Rudd's policies, particularly the first-time vendors boost, is that's reversed the reduction in debt that began beforehand and started pushing us up an increasing debt, which has given us an artificial boost to the economy from growing debt once more. But from my opinion, I just don't think it can be sustained. So I think at some stage we'll see debt ratios going declining once more and GDP following it down.
That sounds like debt deflation to me.
That's what I expect. I mean, my corollary to that marginal productivity of debt graph is to show the relationship between the contribution the change in debt makes to aggregate demand, and I define that as GDP plus the change in debt, and correlate that against the unemployment rate. And the correlation is so close to perfect, it's ridiculous. You get a correlation of over 0.95, or 0.94, pardon me, out of memory, in Australia's case, and 0.88 in America's case. And these things, according to conventional economic theory, there should be no relationship between change in debt and unemployment. So to find a correlation where their theory basically says you shouldn't find anything, and I find a correlation coefficient of greater than 0.9, it's a sign that there's something seriously wrong with conventional economics and also wrong with our conventional economies, because we've become so debt-dependent that increasing debt actually reduces unemployment. Now, that's a tragic situation to be in.
And since the evolution of, well, devolution of neoliberalist economics, the debt ratio, the private debt ratio has really jumped. And it seems that the powers that be are trying to shift the funding costs of society off the public interest and onto private interests. Now, people like Ross Gittins, a famous Australian economic commentator, talks about net foreign debt, and that is the key indicator for him. But you've taken quite a different tact with his private debt.
Oh, yeah, I focus on gross debt for a start. And I focus on private debt in particular. And there we've gone from a comparatively trivial level of private debt, private foreign debt, about 20 years ago when Liberals were running their debt track around the country, to private, and again, I can't have the figures in front of me, but something over $750 billion of private foreign debt. And that really can bankrupt institutions to find they've got to roll their debt over, and then find they can't get financing on terms that are feasible for them to repay out of their cash flows. So it's one of the many points of vulnerability of our society.
Now, you're walking because you lost a bet that housing prices wouldn't fall 40% And it turns out that some elements of the media this week have clarified this bet, Stephen. I'm surprised that a knowledgeable fellow like you didn't read and listen to the transcript, but seems like there's actually 4 years to run on this bet before there's a 40% fall in housing prices. And if that occurs in that time frame, then Macquarie Bank's Rory Robertson will have to do the same walk. What have you seen with the turnaround in housing funding and the 12% drop in Victoria and 27% drop up in New South Wales?
Oh, look, I said that's what I expected, because with the first-time vendors boost sucking so many first-time buyers, literally 250,000 Australian individuals and couples took out the first-time owners boost last year. Well, that sucked towards plenty of people who would have bought in 2010. They're simply not here anymore. Then the banks are starting to reduce loan-to-valuation ratios, and people don't really comprehend what that means. But if you look at Westpac saying they wanted to reduce their maximum LVR from 92% to 87%, that means somebody who had 80 grand saved last year could have made a bit of it on a $1 million property, a property where the vendor would only sell for $1 million. Now they need $130,000 to make that bid. They've got to find an extra 50 grand. That'll take them a while. So those sorts of phenomena, you know, almost necessarily meant a turnaround in prices. So I expected 2010 to be a pretty drastic year after they pulled out the rug that the first time vendors boost gave to the market. But I always knew that was the basis of the bet made. Thing is, I knew Rory Robertson would spin it otherwise. He was always claiming it was a bet based on the treating September 2008 as the peak. Now, if he'd actually said to make a bet where I was saying a 40% fall from the September 2008 level, I would have turned the bet down, because I wasn't arguing that it was the peak. But I argued once the peak was set, and by the way, the bet was pulled on me 1 month after the first-time vendors boost came in, so I knew prices are going to rise. Whatever the peak was to whatever the bottom is, I expect that to be 40%, but I wasn't going to call the peak at being September 2008. That's the spin he put on it, and I knew that if I didn't do this walk when it went past that previous peak, he'd accuse me of welching on the bet. Well, I thought, bugger him. As it happens, I love long-distance running. This was actually tailor-made for me. I'm getting a buzz out of this. I thought I'd do it, and then I can then put the pressure on him. And luckily what's happened is a journalist has done a very good piece of research, gone back and listened to the transcript of the parliamentary speech where Rory surprised me with this bet, listened to what was said, put the whole thing together and said that the basic way you can see the bet is that it was about a bet about a peak to trough fall between the date of the bet being set, which is October 2008, and October 2013, 5 years later, of 20%. Or if you want to go to long term, it'd be 15 years after 2008, so 2023, of 40%. So Rory's still got the demon on his back, and I've already done the walk. And in that sense, I'll be finishing in 2-3 days' time. On that front, it's a bit like to take Paul Keating's old phrase and twist it somewhat. A souffle doesn't have to rise twice, but he still has to consider doing the walk at some stage. I'm delighted by the outcome there.
Everybody thinks we're wrong, mother. Who are they to judge us?
Mother, mother.
Simply cause we wear our hair long,
mother, mother.
Ooh.
We're talking to Professor Steve Keen with a bit of Marvin Gaye today.
And on a broader topic, is interest a kind of rent in the classical sense? Is it income without a cost of production?
Absolutely. And I think this is why, in some ways, I differ with George's analysis. I see the main dilemma in capitalism being the conflict between financial capital and industrial capital. Industrial capital ultimately is productive. And if you look at workers and capitalists, they both ultimately benefit out of the technological developments over time, and demands over wages mean the workers get if an unemployment is not gigantic, they benefit out of the improvements that occur in technology and productivity over time as well. The real albatross around the neck of capitalism is financial capital, when you let it get beyond the level that's necessary to simply finance working capital and some new investment.
But Steve,
and what we've done every time, financial capitalists take over.
What is the majority of debt borrowed for?
The majority of debt in our society now is housing, but that's only because the financial sector exhausted the amount of debt it could pump out of the business sector back in the 87 bubble. And if it hadn't been for Alan Greenspan, and I definitely think he deserved what's called the Dynamite Award for blowing up the global economy. If it hadn't been for Greenspan's rescues of the financial sector in 1987, he probably would have seen a lot of those companies fold, and they would have been scared off extending debt for some substantial time, and they would have had a mini-depression back then, and they wouldn't have got to the household sector. But the household debt levels, both in Australia and America, but particularly Australia, they began to rise after the finance sector found it couldn't hand out debt to the business sector anymore. So the fact that it's got to being debt for land ownership is, I think, a result of neoclassical economists rescuing the financial sector from its own follies and then enabling it to go out searching for somebody else to lend money to and finding they could do it to the household sector. If you look at the Australian data, you'll find that in 1990, mortgage debt was 17% of GDP. It's now 89%. So if the crisis had been allowed to happen back in 87 rather than stopping it, we wouldn't have seen the level of mortgage debt we've seen now, and most of the debt would be associated with industrial companies.
Well, I agree with most of what you said, but just let's clarify that houses depreciate and land appreciates.
Yeah.
So this is one of the language barriers that occurs.
Yeah, land is the thing that's been increasing in price, without a doubt. It's not the houses that are more expensive, it's the land. The land is where the debt is attached, absolutely.
And so if we're to rebalance this playing field between the financial and the industrial sectors of the economy, wouldn't removing land price out of the equation and sinking it back to what can realistically be earned off that one location rather than what it can be flipped for at exorbitant profiteering rates, wouldn't that help pull away the power of the financial sector and at the same time lower the rents that businesses have to pay so there's more left over for workers themselves in wages?
I'm skeptical about that, mate, I'm afraid. I think that the main danger is that if you don't tame the financial beast by preventing people's desire to borrow money for leverage speculation on asset prices, and I think it's still feasible with land tax, that they would find ways to speculate on asset prices even with land taxes, then at some stage you'll get another bubble, and what you would have is the financial instruments being strong enough to remove the legislation that applied taxes to land because it was a restraint of trade, anti-competitive, all the usual jargon they pull out. And that the political weakness of that argument is enormous. I think one of the most important things we can learn from Hyman Minsky is that simple phrase, stability is destabilizing. If you have a period, if the land tax reforms brought in a period of stabilized growth, it would enable the growth of a class that made money out of speculating on the value of land assets. They would then develop the political power to wind those reforms back. So I'm skeptical about it. I think it's far better to attack it at the source and remove the possibility of a bubble in the first place.
But Steve, if we agree that the majority of the debt is for land, and we've both agreed that the financials...
Only for circumstantial reason, mate. If the crisis had been allowed to happen back in 87, it wouldn't be for land, it'd be on industrial capital.
There was a huge land boom in the 80s. I mean, look what's happened to Japan. I mean, it was the same thing in Australia. It was a massive land boom, and it's the same thing in the 70s.
There's a 70s land boom, without a doubt, and it was property speculators who took the debt. Property speculators again in 87, but not households. So it's something, if we think we have to be more careful about our data. I mean, I'm fighting a bit with you, mate.
No, this is good.
I'm very careful about avoiding ideology or prepackaged arguments as our analysis. We have to base ourselves on the empirical data. And if we don't do that again, we're going to fall into the same traps as the neoclassicals did of having an ideological basis for our arguments and analysis and policies, which failed because ideology isn't necessarily reality. So you might know that the only people who hate me more than neoclassical economists are Marxists because I attack them over the labour theory of value.
This is the one reason why I'm a supporter of the Georgist belief, is that it is based on theory and backed up with impeccable data from Brian Kavanagh and Gavin Putlin at the Land Values Research Group.
Brian's work is excellent. I've no doubt about that. Brian's work is excellent. He's identified a lot of important trends there. So I'm not saying it's not an important perspective, but I'm saying that I think that we need we have to go beyond Henry George, just like I said, we've got to go beyond the cardboard cutout version of Marx that Marxists call Marx, to build a new economics. And to me, a large part of this is to be aware of the extent that a set of reforms that look like they're very sensible, and they are sensible in the aftermath to a crisis, can end up being unwound because they actually stop crises happening. We have to find a form of reform that is almost impossible to get rid of, and a large part of that is stopping class formations occurring that give people the power to unwind good ideas. Now, if you have something which still allows the financial sector to develop large power, then at some point they would unwind good Georgist reforms.
I can see that point, but the Australian property market is double the size of the ASX, and a 6% return. It's a huge market, and the top 1% have 60% of their money invested in property around the world. The whole the eyes of neoliberalism are to privatise the global commons. We've seen water sold off. We're seeing 4G electromagnetic spectrum being sold for a pittance around the world. It's not just land, but it's all of these resources that provides the income flows that banks create finance out of. And what
the only thing we're both in agreement about, mate, is that we have to stop the people, and particularly social classes, becoming dependent upon unearned income. Ultimately, the only way to get a functioning capitalist society, or a functioning society in general, is to have one where the source of income is earned, not unearned. And when you look at land speculation and you look at any other form of speculation, people are trying to earn income, get income without earning it. That's the real dilemma in capitalism. And if we direct ourselves at that particular principle, then we're both on the same side.
Set in stone so they can't be unwound by the privileged.
I've got two reforms I wanted to give you, but you and I've talked about them before. One is to limit the amount of debt that can be secured against property to 10 times its annual rental income. Any more than that can't be secured. And in fact, if a borrower decides not to repay that debt, the bank has got no recourse. So simply say the maximum amount is 10 times the annual rental. That ties the amount of debt to the income earning capacity, whether it's actual or imputed, of that property. And that would mean that the maximum leverage in a purchase would be set by the amount of borrowed money there. If I was competing with Jamie Packer to buy the house I live in, he could borrow $260,000 and I could borrow $260,000. He could outbid me, but only by putting in his own cash. So in that case, if you had an increase in house prices, it would mean a reduction in leverage. Where at the moment, an increase in house prices means an increase in leverage, and you've got a positive feedback loop that leads into the sort of crisis we're in now. That's one reform. The other is to redefine shares so that shares which are purchased in an initial public offering last indefinitely. If you actually give your money to a new venture, then you continue to receive whatever dividends come out of that venture with the shares. Once you sell those shares in the secondary market, they last a defined period of time, let's say 25 or 30 years. And that would mean that once you bought a share on the secondary market, you'd be highly unlikely to buy it with borrowed money. because you're leveraging up simply dividends which would terminate at, say, 25 years. So the whole idea is to remove the attraction people currently feel towards taking on leverage to buy capital assets. And that is my argument there, is that banks will pump out debt to anybody they can find who's willing to take it on. If you remove the enticement people face to borrow money to speculate on asset prices, they'll only borrow for limited consumption purposes and for necessary investment. And that should dramatically stabilize the system and stop us getting the debt ratios we've currently managed to accumulate. And then on the other hand, they're legal. They're laws which courts can enforce, and they can enforce with, if necessary, jail sentences. Much more effective than leaving it to ASIC.
I certainly support the second policy. I think that's quite radical and certainly supports the role of private capital in supporting new company formations. But regarding the first one, yeah, limiting debt to rental incomes to 10 years, that seems very similar to a mill tax in a way, in that it accepts the present wealth gap that we have and, from what I can see, won't do much to radically reduce that wealth gap, because all those Kerry Packers of the world will still have that cash at hand to always outbid us, and from that the neo-feudal society will continue.
Well, I think if you look at the level of inequality we've got now, it's drastically related to the level of debt that's been accumulated. In fact, I'll put up a paper on my blog at some stage showing that the mathematical relationship between the level of debt and workers' wages in the simple dynamic model that I'm building at the basis of my Minsky model. And that's turned up in the empirical data as well. The higher the debt levels are, the less workers get. The transfer really goes, financial capitalists get the income that workers would have got with debt levels were lower. So if we lower debt levels from, like in my case, in Australia's case, I could see us lowering debt levels to get back to what seems to be sustainable society in Australia from 165% to 25% of GDP. That would mean a drastic increase in workers' shares of income. But you're never going to get rid of the inequality between workers' incomes and capitalist incomes. This isn't going to happen. But if you get rid of the financial capital and restrain them, you get more for both industrial capital, capitalists and workers. And they ultimately are the productive forces in society in an uncomfortable symbiosis. Beyond that, I don't want to consider trying to cause some social revolution about the nature of society. I think revolutions, you can't tell what's going to be on the other side of a revolution. You can let the system evolve, and you can change some small parameters of it, but to try to get rid of inequality in total, I think, would be potentially to the sort of society we saw in Soviet Russia. So I'm a bit conservative on that front.
Steve Keen, is there anything you would like to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, one little thing. Donations would be gratefully received to Swags for the Homeless, which is one of the charity I'm raising money for in this walk. If you go to my keenwalk.com.au, you'll see a link there to the Swags for Homeless. I think that's a fabulous case of really trying to reduce, if not inequality, then at least the suffering caused by being on the streets.
So there you have it, Professor Steve Keen on The Renegade Economist. Yes, we are open to criticism. It does help push your mind, push your policies, push your thinking so that we can meet everyone's concerns. Certainly much of what Steve says had plenty of validity to it. I'm confident we've defended many of those positions on the show over the years. But yes, when you hear that there are more mobile phones in India than there are toilets, some major things have to happen in this world, let alone the struggles people have in a lucky country like Australia. So my name's Carl Fitzgerald. Thanks a lot for listening. Check out earthsharing.org.au. Back to Marvin. We'll be right back.
spend your Saturday evenings with 3CR. 7 p.m. Blue-Green Footprints, alternative country and roots music with a focus on Australian artists. 8 p.m. Shake, Rattle and Roll, presented by the Rock and Roll Appreciation Society.